But in this report says that if urgent action is not taken, the number of people that will not have access to basic drinking water will double from 2016, which was about 930 million people, to 2.4 billion people. Currently, as you mentioned, we're already at 2 billion people. Now, a linked report, the World Water Assessment Report, did an assessment in Nigeria, in Africa for the very first time. And I'd like to just quote some of the figures or the findings. In Africa, not a single country, not to talk of the sub-region, scored above 90 out of the 100 possible points. The five top countries had just about an average of 60 to 70. In the past 5 years, 25 out of 54 countries in Africa made no progress at all. Access to basic drinking water ranged from 37% in the Central African region to about 99% in Egypt. Coming to my country, Nigeria, which is very pivotal, because Nigeria, with its population of about 200 million people, has more people than the whole of West Africa combined. And in terms of regression, access to basic water reduced from 67% from 70% in 2018 to 67% in 2021. What are the implications? The World Water Report reminds us, and like you said, the current UN Secretary General and the past ones have said that access to water, water security is pivotal to achieving every other human right, every sustainable goal. So for us in Africa, it's a major issue, the impact on health, impact of on education, impact on economy, impact on security. So this World Water Report calls for synergizing, speeding up, scaling up, and sustaining. I'll leave it at that for now.
Mohamed Mahmoud, you are Director of Climate and Water Program at the Middle East Institute. We're speaking to you in Phoenix. Can you talk about what particularly is happening in the Middle East right now around water? We always hear about oil and gas and wars for oil. What about wars for water?
Well, good morning, Amy, and thanks again for having me on the show. I think just to link with the report and what was just mentioned, one of the main takeaways is that we're certainly not on track for the sixth Sustainable Development Goal as it relates to clean, safe water and sanitation to meet the mark that was intended by 2030. And I think that's just one piece of the puzzle when we look at those issues related to water quality. Similarly, in the Middle East, North Africa, and certainly other parts of the world share this issue, when it comes to water security, I think there's multiple dimensions that are being impacted. One, on the water supply side, and that is overlaid with the impacts of climate change. Certainly, climate change amplification has caused droughts, certainly in the region, to become more sustained and severe. The region itself is already naturally prone to being dry and arid, but with the overlay of climate change, freshwater sources have been stressed. I mean, to put into perspective, 12 of the 15 most water-stressed countries in the world reside in the Middle East and North Africa region. So what does that look like? Groundwater supplies have been the predominant source of supply for the region for as long as folks have been utilizing water. Those have been over-depleted. The few surface water systems and rivers, certainly the two biggest, the Nile River Basin and the Tigris-Euphrates system, because of the impacts of climate change, these systems that rely on high elevation water being generated from snowpack or precipitation are experiencing less generation of water from these higher elevations. That causes an issue, certainly when we think about transboundary nations, certainly in the Nile, Ethiopia being upstream in the Blue Nile, Egypt, Sudan downstream, causing tensions because of the reduction of the water supply, similarly in the Tigris-Euphrates between Turkey downstream to Syria and Iraq. That's just the water supply angle. When we look at water demand, with less water available, there's a lot more competition from the different sectors of water use. The biggest, actually, is agriculture, which was mentioned in the report itself. About 60 to 70% of water use globally on average, and certainly from country to country, goes towards agricultural water use to support food production and food security. An order of magnitude less than that is water needed for human consumption, so residential or urban water demand. And then the other category is industrial water use to support manufacturing, energy production, power plants need water for cooling, and so forth. So with less water, these sectors are, in essence, becoming in competition with each other. The other piece that's also of concern is water conveyance issues. What I mean by that is, how do we move water from the source to where it's being used, whether through open channel canals, conveyance pipelines? Certain parts of the Middle East have water conveyance infrastructure that is so old or has been neglected in terms of repair and maintenance. Certainly when we look at places like Lebanon and Jordan, some parts of their water infrastructure is losing up to 40 to 50% of the water being transmitted from source, at least to residential demand. That's a lot of water wasted that could be saved to help mitigate some of these issues of not enough water and too much demand. And then, of course, the last piece, which we just really talked about, is water quality. When we think of where water tends to be transmitted or conveyed the most, these tend to be towards urban centers where more populations reside in the region. The drawback of that is those communities that live in rural areas outside of these more dense networks where water is being conveyed from source to utilization, those areas tend to be neglected. And in some cases, the concern, and we've seen this in Syria certainly over the last few years because of conflict and other issues happening there, that these rural communities that are outside these urban centers because of economic conditions, rising costs, not being within the networks of water transmission, tend to take water directly from these surface water systems like the Tigris-Euphrates directly. And of course, without proper treatment and adequate water treatment, many of these people can fall ill and could cause an outbreak of waterborne illnesses. So certainly the report highlights, I think, the water quality component in terms of sanitation, clean water. It does mention the issue of agricultural water use being so high. But I think there's also these other issues that compound the water security question, certainly in the Middle East, but you can certainly draw parallels to other parts of the world as well.
And as we begin to wrap up, Oluwaji Onabolu, you have talked about water rights as human rights, and you say that people should be held, who are in power, should be held accountable for war crimes. Explain.
Okay, well, I used the word water crimes. I said if there is a term called war crimes, why don't we have water crimes? Because we normally say water is life. However, for 353 million people in Africa, those 353 million people that lack access to opportunities, that health, income generation, education opens for them because the political leadership has failed to provide opportunities for them to access this basic resource, I believe that the sector and the world really should be talking about water crimes in terms of political accountability. Because without accountability, we will not be able to ensure that the resources are going to where they are supposed to go to and to whom they are supposed to reach.
Bolawaji Onabolu, we want to thank you for being with us. President of an NGO in Nigeria focused on water sanitation, hygiene and public health. Nigeria, the most populous nation in Africa. And Mohamed Mahmoud, director of Climate and Water Program at the Middle East Institute, speaking to us from Arizona. We're going to stay in Arizona now. This is Democracy Now! As we continue from one river, talking about the Nile, to the Colorado River. At the UN Water Development Conference, it was U.S. Secretary of the Interior, Deb Haaland, who delivered the U.S. statement at the UN Water Conference. She also spoke about indigenous governance of shared waters and the importance of indigenous-led conservation in addressing the climate and drought crises. This comes after the U.S. Supreme Court heard oral arguments last Monday on whether to allow the Navajo Nation to pursue a claim that the federal government has a duty to address the Native American tribes' water rights. Here's now the environmental news site Grist reported on last week's Supreme Court hearing, where the justices seem narrowly divided. Quote, if the Navajo win, they will have a narrow but workable path to secure a significant water settlement on the Colorado River. But if they lose, their litigation over the river will come to an end, forcing them to look elsewhere for a solution to decades of water access problems. For more, we're joined in Fort Defiance, Arizona, by Crystal Tully Cordova, principal hydrologist for the Navajo Nation Department of Water Resources Water Management Branch, covering 27,000 square miles of reservation land that straddles New Mexico, Arizona, and Utah, much of which borders the Colorado River. Welcome to Democracy Now! Talk about your experience growing up without running water as part of the Navajo Nation, who lives in the Colorado River Basin, and the ongoing lack of access to water there now as the West battles a historic drought.
Thank you, Amy. The opportunity to be able to be in the position that I am now in is to be able to secure a sustainable water future for Navajo residents within the Navajo Nation. And it's important to consider what the challenges are associated with, you know, the drought that we've been experiencing, the impact on water supply. Within the Navajo Nation, you know, we are securing our water future by securing our water rights and protecting our water rights, trying to resolve some of our water rights that we have that are unresolved, while at the same time, we also have projects that we are diversifying our water portfolio with projects like the Navajo Gallup Water Supply that will bring San Juan River water, a tributary to the Colorado River, to be able to service 43 Navajo communities. Currently, we have the Cutter Lateral, a portion of that big water project that is servicing 8 Navajo communities currently. And, you know, the listeners might be curious, why is there a need to be able to secure the water future? As described earlier by the people that were a part of the show, you know, groundwater challenges are definitely impact of our availability to access the water. And so we, in the Navajo Nation, we have water quality challenges such as brackish water. So if people don't know what brackish water is, it's salty water. In addition to that, we have legacy mining issues. And added on top of all of that are climate change impacts to waters. And so shallow aquifers that we call alluvial aquifers that are very dependent on precipitation recharge, but in a time of prolonged drought, definitely have their challenges with water availability.
Well, let me ask you, Crystal Tully Cordova, about water rights, and if you can talk about what's at stake in this Supreme Court case.
So I am hopeful for the Supreme Court case. At this time, you know, we really don't have an understanding what the outcome might be, and we won't have an outcome of what that might be until June. But In the Navajo Nation, what we continue to do is to work on water projects, regional water supply systems that interconnect smaller public water systems to be able to secure our water future.
Can you talk about the water infrastructure and particularly the Biden administration and its stance on Navajo land?
Yeah, so there has been funding that has been available under the American Rescue Plan Act, the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act. The Navajo Nation, of its own funding of ARPA, the American Rescue Plan Act funding that it received, invested $215 million for water and wastewater projects. And then even at a community level, the community representatives had another opportunity to be able to invest in water and wastewater infrastructure projects with the funding that they've received as well. With regards to the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act, the Indian Health Service, which also helps by connecting homes to the public water system, received $3.5 billion under the what is also known as a bipartisan infrastructure law. And we are hopeful that this funding, you know, that we're working every day to be able to close the clean water access gap within the Navajo Nation. And there are a large number of projects that need to be done, regional water systems that provide that water supply that allows the opportunity for connection of homes to clean, reliable drinking water. At the same time, it's also important to understand, you know, what the UN had in its sustainable water report, sanitation, you know, water in is water out. And it equally important is because both of those contribute to a successful water system. So we're working on both accesses for water, both sanitation and also access to clean water.
Crystal Tully-Cordova, I want to thank you so much for being with us, Principal Hydrologist for the Navajo Nation Department of Water Resources, Water Management Branch. Next up, we remember the human rights leader, lawyer, Randall Robinson, founder of TransAfrica. Stay with us.
Quand les princes du port gardent en main le sort, ami, de milliers d'exilés mal du pays. Quand tu rêves la nuit exilé de ton île, entends-tu tous ces cris, ces rumeurs de ta ville? Les musiques dans les cours, les jaseries des commères, les enfants de carrefour et les vagues de la mer. Toi tu traînes ta vie et ton mal du pays, ami.
The Mal du Pays, Homesickness, by the Haitian singer-songwriter Mano Charlemagne. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we end today's show, remembering the human rights leader, lawyer, Randall Robinson, who's died at the age of 81 in St. Kitts, where he's lived since 2001. Randall Robinson was the founder of TransAfrica, played a key role in the launching of the Free South Africa movement, was arrested many times at the South African embassy in Washington, D.C., protesting against the apartheid regime. 2007, I interviewed him about his book, An Unbroken Agony, Haiti, From Revolution to the Kidnapping of a President. He began by talking about how broadcaster Tavis Smiley and former California Congressmember Ron Dellums learned of U.S. plans to oust Aristide.
When I was a child growing up in Richmond, Virginia, we were called Negroes. No one I knew why we were called that. No one knew the provenance of that word. It had no connection to what we might have been before we were blocked from view by that lethal, opaque space of slavery. And so we didn't know anything about ourselves, except we'd been called this, but not by ourselves. And it turns out that it's much like the case of the sardine. There's no such thing as a sardine, as a fish living free in the ocean. It only becomes one when it is captured and put in a can. And we were only called Negroes when we were labeled during slavery as that, as a way of severing us from any memory of what we had been. And so we lost our mothers, our fathers, our families, our religions, our languages, our cultures, our memories of what we had been. And so we thought we had no history before slavery. And this name, this new name, this new label helped to facilitate that loss of memory. Now, memory is the active agent of all collective social progress. If you can't remember yourself, you're suffering from serious debilitation. This novel is the story of an extraordinary woman who is a poor blind waitress in Richmond, Virginia, who remembers past lives. And so she remembers Timbuktu in the late 1300s when her father was a priest who underwent cataract surgery at the University of Timbuktu. She remembers her days in ancient Egypt when the two Egypts were united thousands of years before. She remembers lives in West Africa. She remembers all of this, and she tells it to her grandson, who wants to be a writer. And they have a special relationship, and she swears him to secrecy that he tell no one that she has these memories, so people will think she's a bit fruity, as she says. But she remembers these lives in extraordinary detail, and he is inspired by it. Now, you see, he gains his confidence from it. And this is, of course, to symbolize the enormous consequence. Sometimes when we think of slavery, we calculate the economic consequence of it. But we have not calculated the psychosocial consequence of it unless we factor in the loss of memory, which was occasioned by a deliberate and systematic program imposed from those by those who controlled us.
When you were in Trans-Africa and we were working in Washington, the climate in Washington in the 80s and 90s was just more incarceration. Did any of the political leaders that you dealt with realize the long-term impact of what was happening?
I recall that. When we were first being arrested at the embassy and I went to jail that first night, everyone in the lockup with me was black.
This was you were being arrested for protesting apartheid.
For protesting at the embassy. Everyone was black. And I had some sense of this. I think at the time I was told that one out of every three young black males in the District of Columbia was under one or another arm of the criminal justice system. And what stunned me about it and what continues to bother me about it is that when we were struggling during a civil rights movement, some of us were in better positions to benefit from this change that was coming than others were. And so while we had all been in the same boat during segregation, when change came, we weren't all in the same boat anymore. Some of us could escape, but others of us were bottom stuck. And I don't believe that those of us who escaped worked as hard, as tenaciously since, to remember those of us who could not. And the result is that we now see our future as a people in America being warehoused. How can we not be concerned in some relentless way about the fate of all of these young black people mm-hmm. who are being imprisoned? Because we are indissolubly bound up with them. Mm-hmm. Their future is our future. Our future is their future. And we have to be mindful of that. But it doesn't so much penetrate if we don't have news of it every day. So many people don't know.
Randall Robinson, talking about movements, you spearheaded the anti-apartheid movement in this country, getting arrested numerous times, among other places, in front of the South African embassy. You fasted almost unto the death to stop the to fight the U.S. government, President Clinton, I think, at the time, to allow Haitians to come into this country at the time of the bloody coup of 1991 to 1994 in Haiti. Talk about the power of movements and what you see from your perspective now living in St. Kitts, having quit America, the name of one of your books, what you think needs to happen in this country.
Just 12% of the people who commit nonviolent drug infractions are black. I think 56% of those, nonetheless, who are prosecuted, and something on the order of 75% of those who are imprisoned. I mean, we can see the striking unfairness of it. But we have to find a way to get that information to people. Outrage has to be informed by information to go anywhere. South Africa worked because everybody knew about the apartheid system when we went to jail. And so it was instant. This is a little bit more difficult. I mean, we're backward in the world in so many ways. We find ourselves in bed with China, Iran, and two or three other nations in our embrace of the death penalty, when the rest of the world is moving in the other direction. But 75% of those executed are black and Hispanic. And so the unfairness of it is seen in the statistics of who pays and who doesn't. We get sentences twice as long for commission of the same crime. It's just fundamentally unfair. And the question, Amy, is how we can put this together in a way that is consumable and inspiring to people, to let them know that this is not just a black or racial issue. It's an issue for all Americans who care about democracy and equity and fair play and decency. And that's what we have to do. We're killing our own country's future, is what we're doing. And we're killing genius in jail cells that does not have a chance to blossom and to flower.
That was Randall Robinson in 2013 in an interview Juan Gonzalez and I did with him and Michelle Alexander. You can see the whole interview at democracynow.org. We'll also link to his interview in 2007 on Haiti. Randall Robinson just died this weekend at the age of 81 in St. Kitts, where he'd lived since 2001. He was the founder of the group TransAfrica, played a key role in the launching of the Free South Africa movement. He was arrested many times at the South African embassy in Washington, D.C., protesting against the apartheid regime. His books included The Debt, What America Owes to Blacks, and Quitting America, The Departure of a Black Man from His Native Land, as well as the book An Unbroken Agony, Haiti, From Revolution to the Kidnapping of a President. To see all of our interviews, go to democracynow.org with Randall Robinson. Democracy Now!'s Juan Gonzalez is moderating an online panel today on Chicago's 2023 mayoral race, reclaiming Harold Washington's multiracial coalition. You can see details at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is also currently accepting applications for a digital fellow. You can learn more and apply at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Tarasena, Tammy Warnoff, Charina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astudio, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Hani Masood, and Sanji Lopez. Our executive director is Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley, John Randolph, Paul Powell, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Noguera, Hugh Grant, Dennis Moynihan, David Prude, and Dennis McCormick. To see all of our interview segments, you can go to democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman.
Hi, this is Jesse Brown, the host of Canada Land, Canada's only media criticism program. Every week I talk to some of the most interesting people in the country about some of the things that matter most. We talk about the news media, about comedy, film, music, and politics. And you can now listen on CJSF 90.1 FM every Monday at 5 p.m. Wait for it.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, SFU's community radio station broadcasting live from Burnaby, BC.